The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated August 22/August 29, 2022. Time is in bold, capital, large, gray lettering, surrounded by the borders, red on the outside and an inner border of a narrow margin of white. Time is superimposed upon a turquoise color background. It is concentric circles, and at the bottom there's an orange rectangle that appears to be jutting out into space or water or a turquoise background. Someone is kneeling on it, probably a female. It looks like someone with a large brimmed sun hat, and that person with its left hand is pointing toward the most central of the concentric circles, which is nearly a dot. How to Do More Good is the headline. Beginning today, I'll be reading The Virus Hunters, Private Companies, Academic Centers, and Governments Are Teaming Up to Spot Emerging Health Threats by Alice Park. A photograph here by Guy Crist for Time. It's a rather dark-looking room occupied by two individuals, primarily whose backs we see. They are female. They're both wearing, I would call them, lab smocks. I don't know if they're fabric or a plastic or other synthetic material. They're seated at large screens. However, the screens may actually be the openings of enclosures. Both individuals have long hair. One has her hair falling straight down her back. The other has hers in a bun almost on top of her head. Both are wearing masks. There is some kind of a contraption next to the wall. It looks like a small table or cabinet with some electronic devices on it. Again, this is The Virus Hunters by Alice Park. It's lengthy. I may abridge it. What do you miss most? Even though experts had long warned the next pandemic was imminent, few saw SARS-CoV-2 coming. In the early days of the outbreak, researchers scrambled to collect samples from people who had mysteriously developed fevers, coughs, and breathing problems. Pretty soon, they realized the disease-causing culprit was a new virus humans had not seen before. Lacking a coordinated global response, some countries acted quickly to develop tests for the novel coronavirus, while others with fewer resources were left behind. But with global travel, 100,000 flights a day in 2019, far more common than when past plagues had hit, these inequities meant everyone was vulnerable. The solution, shutting the world down, closing borders, asking people to stay safely indoors. It soon became clear the world would weather this pandemic only by working together, and that governments alone could not necessarily save us. Surveillance into the microbial world was necessary in order to predict coming outbreaks, or at least detect them more quickly after they hit. Some in the private sector saw an opportunity to harness their expertise and resources in testing and manufacturing to benefit both public health and their businesses. In 2021, the global healthcare company Abbott started the Abbott Pandemic Defense Coalition, APDC, the first convergence of public health and academic experts led by a private company. It now includes 16 members based in 13 countries. Its mission? To detect new pathogens that threaten to wreak havoc on the world and contain them before it is too late. The experiment is just beginning, but it is already paying off. APDC partners were among the first in the world to spot several dangerous mutations of the COVID-19 virus, including Omicron, just as they were emerging, which allowed countries to prepare by increasing testing, doubling down on vaccine programs, and advising infected people to isolate. It was a big change from being blindsided by the original version of the virus. The virus hunters are not only watching out for new versions of SARS-CoV-2, but also continuing their search for the next potentially dangerous bugs. In June, as monkeypox began infecting people around the world, the network monitored genetic sequences of the virus that showed it had come from the less virulent of two strains, endemic in Africa, and that existing vaccines would continue to be effective. Using that data, Abbott developed a monkeypox PCR test for research purposes only that coalition members are using to track the virus, contain its spread, and detect any changes in the viral genome as soon as they appear. APDC is also continuing to monitor other emerging infectious diseases, including hepatitis, Zika, dengue, meningitis, and yellow fever. As humans continue to encroach on previously wild geographical regions, we are more likely to come into contact with pathogens that can pose a threat to health. Climate change is also raising the risk of infectious diseases as species that carry viruses or bacteria expand to broader geographic areas. The coalition's goal is to build the next generation of virologists, virus hunters, and epidemiologists, says Gavin Cloherty, who leads APDC. Preventing the next pandemic is a team sport, and collaboration is the only way we win. COVID-19 has turned out to be an ideal proving ground for this type of coalition. The virus is constantly evolving, and by comparing genetic sequences from COVID-19 patients in one region to previous samples, scientists at partner labs can spot any noteworthy differences and monitor them more closely. Any changes, especially if they appear in multiple parts of the world simultaneously, could represent mutations that make it easier for the virus to spread or cause more serious disease. If any lab in the coalition detects a concerning pattern, it immediately shares it with the group. If others are seeing the same trend, Abbott and the partners work to ensure the current tests can still detect the new strain. Should the tests fail, then Abbott scientists would get to work revising them. We are able to build tools like tests and assays that can be distributed to our partners and potentially manufacture them at scale if needed, says Cloherty. Most important, the coalition also shares any concerning discoveries with global public health officials, foundations, and government leaders, including the World Health Organization, WHO, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as well as on global public databases. Knowing what might be coming can help health authorities deploy limited COVID-19 resources to where they are needed most. The coalition serves Abbott's business purposes, given that the company has a long history of providing diagnostic tests for pathogens, including its popular Binax Now COVID-19 rapid at-home tests. Being the first to hear of any changes in SARS-CoV-2 would give Abbott scientists a running start at modifying diagnostics. Finding more variants and more viruses means more tests, which makes sense for its bottom line. But the public health partners benefit too. Abbott wholly funds the coalition, providing scientists with state-of-the-art equipment, training, and lab supplies to collect samples and conduct genetic sequencing. Abbott also shares its scientific and manufacturing expertise. Since it has been following viruses globally for about 30 years from the start of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, that ongoing surveillance program is the predecessor to APDC. It monitors known pathogens instead of new or emerging ones, as APDC does, for mutations that might affect diagnostic tests and treatments. The new coalition also links otherwise isolated public health labs into a tight-knit community that can quickly disseminate information about new pathogens or genetic aberrations they discover. Although it's a private company and diagnostic kits are to be sold, what I see is an effort to bring down scientific borders and increase communication across the globe, says Esper Callis, professor of infections and parasitic diseases at the University of Sao Paulo, a coalition partner. Being led by a private company sets APDC apart, but it is not the only collaborative group of virus hunters. The Rockefeller Foundation's Pandemic Prevention Institute, for example, which recently partnered with the Pasteur Institute, is a philanthropic-led group of 33 members that act as sentinels for emerging infectious diseases that could become public health threats. Partnerships among entities like public health groups, foundations, and private companies are increasingly essential for mounting a quick and efficient response against fast-moving viruses. Perhaps the best example of the power of such alliances was the U.S.'s ability to develop, test, manufacture, and distribute millions of COVID-19 vaccines in less than a year. The feat never would have been possible if the U.S. government had not funded pharmaceutical companies' costs in developing and manufacturing these vaccines. Doing so helped the U.S. and the rest of the world benefit from the revolutionary mRNA shots that had never before been used against a virus. Experts believe the only way to prepare for the next pandemic is not just to create more coalitions like these, but also to sustain them between public health emergencies. Public-private partnerships are essential for disease surveillance, testing, treatments, you name it, says Dr. Eric Topol, director and founder of the Scripps Research Translational Institute. We do better if those groups are working together. So far, APDC members have contributed to identifying three major SARS-CoV-2 variants in June and July 2020. As the coalition was being formed, hospitals in South Africa noticed a rapid uptick in COVID-19 patients. We found the exact same variant in samples from clinics that were hundreds of kilometers away. So we knew it was widespread and that we potentially had a new variant, says Tulio de Oliveira, who leads the Center for Epidemic Response and Innovation, CERI, at Stellenbosch University in South Africa, an APDC partner. Data from the South African hospital suggested younger people were most effective and that they were getting sicker than people who had been infected with the earlier version of the virus. De Oliveira alerted global health authorities to the new variant, which allowed them to prepare for a potential wave of hospitalizations. Back in Chicago, at Abbott's headquarters, scientists quickly determined the company's existing PCR and recently authorized at-home rapid tests for SARS-CoV-2 could still detect the new variant, which the WHO later dubbed Beta. Several months later, Brazilian researchers issued a similar alarm. Researchers at the University of Sao Paulo, led by Esther Sabino, had worked with Oxford scientists during Brazil's 2015 Zika outbreak to develop a mobile, compact machine to process virus samples. Using it to scan COVID-19 samples in spring 2020, they noticed unusual sequences coming from northern Brazil in the Amazon basin. The changes to the viral genome turned out to signal a new variant, Gamma, that would go on to cause significant disease and death in the area. But as tragic as Gamma's local effects were, early detection likely prevented it from causing even more disease and death elsewhere in the country and world, says Callis. What would have happened if Gamma would not have been discovered until it reached a big city such as Sao Paulo of 20 million people, he says. We would have been caught completely off guard. Luckily, coalition scientists confirmed existing rapid tests worked to detect Gamma just as they had for Beta. Then came Omicron. A lab technician in South Africa was conducting routine genetic sequencing of random SARS-CoV-2 samples in November 2021 and noticed the virus was missing one of three protein signatures that all the previous variants had had. The technician tipped off De Oliveira's group, which conducted a more detailed analysis, showing the virus had picked up a shocking 30 or so mutations, most of them in the spike protein, the very region targeted by vaccine and drug makers. In the span of 6 hours, hundreds of samples from more than 100 South African clinics arrived at De Oliveira's labs. Sequencing those samples revealed the same pattern of mutations. Within 36 hours, De Oliveira had notified the health minister and president of South Africa, along with the WHO, that a new version of the virus was brewing. Within days, De Oliveira also looped in coalition partners around the world to give countries a head start in looking for the genetic changes signaling the Omicron variant, which the WHO named shortly after. The collaboration quickly put lots of different eyes on the same urgent problem. Each of us brings a different skill set, says Dr. Sunil Solomon, assistant professor of medicine in infectious diseases at Johns Hopkins and director of YRG Care in Chennai, India, one of the coalition partners. People can go down rabbit holes thinking what they are working on is important, so they forget what the bigger picture is. The coalition is focused on translating what all of us find for clinical relevance to make sure whatever we are doing is tailored toward the public's health. A prominent proponent of this type of virus hunting squad is Bill Gates. In his 2022 book, How to Prevent the Next Pandemic, he describes the ideal global infectious disease monitoring system, which he dubs GERM, for global epidemic response and mobilization. The idea is to maintain a network of scientists whose sole mission is to stay on top of infectious disease cases and raise alerts if new, unexplained infections are bubbling up anywhere in the world. GERM would also be responsible for sending teams of experts to help countries where outbreaks are occurring. Similar systems already exist, but they are not robust enough. The WHO tracks emerging public health threats through its Global Outbreak and Alert Response Network, which provides assistance to countries confronting emergencies. But its responsibilities extend beyond such outbreaks to include crises in food safety, natural and man-made disasters, and the release of chemical toxins. The CDC also surveils emerging pathogens and maintains international teams and mobile groups ready to provide assistance if countries ask for it. Unfortunately, enthusiasm and funding for maintaining these types of systems ramps up during outbreaks, such as Ebola in the 2010s and now COVID-19, only to die down when the threat retreats. It's out of sight, out of mind, says Sumit Chanda, professor of immunology and microbiology at Scripps Research, of the existing preparedness strategy. Gates calculates it would cost about $1 billion, to support 3,000 full-time virus hunters in a sustained war against invisible marauders, less than 1,000th of what nations currently spend on defense. The funding, Gates says, should not come solely from philanthropists or foundations like his, but also from governments, which need to invest in preparing for public health threats in the same way they shore up defenses against other dangers, and from private companies, which can provide experience and resources in the form of tests and manufacturing capabilities. The prospectus for these investments is written in the headlines. Coronaviruses alone have caused significant outbreaks several times over recent decades. And that is just one family of viruses. As the world learned with COVID-19, by the time a pandemic hits, it's already too late to start creating relationships and building networks among different countries to share information in real time. And the network's potential is only as extensive as its reach. The more partners linking together, the more likely the world will benefit from discoveries. COVID-19 also made clear monitoring for changes in existing pathogens and keeping a lookout for new ones is not a job for governments and global health groups alone. Industry can play important roles in controlling health outbreaks, but there often are not financial incentives for businesses to do so. I do not see enough companies who've made billions of dollars using some of that great profit to do things that are not in their self-interest, says Topol. Instead, the world is left with a patchwork system of public health sentinels that is riddled with enough holes for pathogens to slip through undetected, giving them enough time to spread before diagnostic tests, vaccines, or treatments can be developed. And that article was only slightly abridged. Under the heading Healthcare, Kansas Previews Roadmap to Protect Abortion Access by Abigail Abrams and Madeline Carlisle. Ann Malia had canvassed with an abortion rights group for months, urging Kansas residents to vote no on a ballot measure that would have amended the state constitution to say there was no right to an abortion in the state. But she never in a million years thought Kansas voters would so strongly reject the constitutional amendment August 2, with 59% voting no and 41% voting yes. The vote was the first major win for abortion rights supporters since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade June 24. The outcome demonstrated a strong public backlash to the Supreme Court's decision and created a roadmap for both Democrats running in November's midterms and abortion rights advocates who hope to use similar ballot measures to enshrine abortion rights in other state constitutions. Registered Republicans greatly outnumber Democrats in Kansas, and the state consistently favors the GOP in presidential elections. But Kansas also has plenty of moderate and unaffiliated voters, and abortion rights supporters appeal to them in their outreach ahead of the primary. Voters in increasingly Democratic areas, like the Kansas City suburbs, rejected the measure by huge margins. And the vote in rural areas was closer than either side expected. In urban and rural counties alike, the vote to protect abortion rights performed better than Joe Biden did against Donald Trump in 2020. The outcome in Kansas may preview how much the issue of abortion, which has historically motivated more voters on the anti-abortion side, could influence the midterm elections. Turnout in Kansas was unusually high. At least 922,300 people voted on the ballot measure, compared with the roughly 457,000 people who voted in the 2018 primaries. Voter registration surged 1,000% June 24, the day Roe v. Wade was struck down, and the increases were particularly strong among Democrats and women, according to Tom Bonnier of political data firm Target Smart. Yet it remains to be seen how abortion will stack up against issues like inflation in voters' minds come November. Even if they disagree with Republican candidates on the issue, says Miles Coleman, associate editor of the election forecaster Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia's Center for Politics, is it going to override their concerns about inflation or the economy? Kansas vote also highlights the key role state constitutions will play in the nation's abortion landscape going forward. Without a federal right to abortion, the procedure's legality will largely be determined at the state level. Kansas is a model for a path to restoring reproductive rights across the country through direct democracy, Alexis McGill Johnson, president of Planned Parenthood Association Fund, said in a statement. Abortion will be on the ballot elsewhere this year, with voters in Kentucky, California, and Vermont set to weigh in. Advocates have also submitted more than 750,000 signatures to put a constitutional amendment protecting abortion rights on the ballot in Michigan this fall. If abortion rights can win in Kansas, it is advocacy inspiring, says Kelly Hall, executive director of the Fairness Project, which is working on the ballot measures in Michigan and Vermont. I hope that it is also politically inspiring for folks to not run away from this issue, no matter what corner of the country they are in. The brief news, politics. Trump allies seek political gain from FBI Mar-a-Lago search by Brian Bennett. Within hours of FBI agents searching Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence August 8, the Republican National Committee urged voters to fight back with their wallets. In an unprecedented move, Joe Biden's Department of Justice raids President Trump's home at Mar-a-Lago, the RNC's call for donations, read. Donate any amount right now to show your support for the GOP to take back Congress and stop Joe Biden. It was one of multiple signs the unprecedented move by federal law enforcement to execute a search warrant on a former president's home was quickly mobilizing Trump's base and allowing his supporters to monetize what was otherwise a stunning escalation of the federal investigations into him. Federal officials have been investigating allegations that Trump mishandled classified documents while he was in office and when he moved out of the White House January 20, 2021, taking boxes of papers that arguably should have been handled by the National Archives. It was not immediately clear whether those documents were the sole reason for the search, but it fit the profile of a president who struggled with the concept of public service. In a forthcoming book, longtime Trump chronicler Maggie Haberman reports the president more than once flushed documents down toilets. With few details available, both Trump supporters and critics were left speculating as to the purpose of the search. For allies of the former president, however, the move had nothing to do with Trump's past actions or the possibility of a Justice Department acting independently of politics and everything to do with 2024. This continuous, irrational, obsessive quest to destroy Donald Trump is just Further proof, the Biden administration is just solely focused on politics and not addressing the issues the American people really care about, says Hogan Gidley, Trump's former White House deputy press secretary, who still speaks with him. Even former officials who have criticized the 45th president warned the mishandling of classified documents might be interpreted as a skimpy rationale. This better not be chicken SH blank T, says a former senior Trump White House official who requested anonymity to speak more freely. This, I am hoping, goes beyond simply not complying with some archiving laws, or DOJ just handed Donald Trump the Republican nominee and potentially the presidency, Alyssa Farah, Trump's former White House Director of Strategic Communications turned critic, said on CNN. The Department of Justice appears to be accelerating investigations that may reach deep into Trump's orbit, along with investigations into his handling of classified documents. Prosecutors have ramped up the investigation into the January 6 attack on the Capitol. In a separate investigation in Georgia, close allies of Trump have been asked to testify before a grand jury, hearing allegations of interference in the 2020 election. The U.S. District Court of Appeals for D.C. recently affirmed the Internal Revenue Service can hand over Trump's tax returns to the House Ways and Means Committee, potentially giving Democrats critical information about Trump's finances. The bolt from Mar-a-Lago came a day after Senate Democrats passed a landmark climate and health care package, one of a run of measures that lifted Democratic hopes for the midterms. Republicans already harping on Democrats for approving more money for the IRS found their theme of government overreach amped by the FBI search. There's no question this will mobilize Republican voters, Gidley says. There's a photo here. It's a dark, very dark, dark blue sky in the background, but noticeably black silhouettes of palm trees in the foreground. Even in front of those, a white or silver-colored pickup is in the frame with a large sign or flag hanging on a pole over the pickup bed. And it says something about Trump, and I can't read the rest. And then in front of that is a police car. I think it says Palm Beach, Police Palm Beach. It's a cruiser with its lights on, so we can see that pickup fairly clearly. It has red lights on the roof, and it's a blue and white vehicle, like an SUV. The caption reads, "A Trump supporter drives past the ex-president's Mar-a-Lago estate, August 8. And here are milestones. The first is died Olivia Newton-John, a silky star. This is written by Stephanie Zakarik. And there's a photo at the bottom. It's not very large, but it is of a young woman with extremely fluffy blonde hair. She's smiling, a huge smile. She has hoop earrings that appear to be gold, an off-the-shoulder black dress or top, because we see only the top of her, dark brown eyes looking directly at the camera. It is Olivia Newton-John. Among the sunniest pleasures of top 40 radio in the 1970s and 80s were the songs of Olivia Newton-John, who died August 8 at age 73 following a decades-long battle with breast cancer. Her silky flaxen voice in pillowy ballads like Have You Never Been Mellow and subtly foxy seductions like A Little More Love always brought with it a rush of joy and warmth. Her films were ambrosial, too. In the 1978 Grease, Newton-John's good girl Sandy embodied both the wistfulness and the sunburnt bliss of summer's last days. her 1980 film Xanadu, in which she played a singing, dancing, roller skating goddess, was not a hit, but to watch it today is to revel in Newton-John's rainbow radiance and to see how a performer can be both of her time while also like a breezy emissary from Mount Olympus, living forever outside it. Killed Ayman al-Zawahiri, a September 11 plotter who found haven in Afghanistan. This short column is written by Brian Bennett with W.J. Hennigan. A photo above the column is of Ayman al-Zawahiri with Osama bin Laden in 2001. They appear to be sitting on cushions. There's a weapon between them. Bin Laden is wearing a camouflage vest or jacket over his white attire. Al-Zawahiri is wearing more like a gray sweater over his white attire. Both are wearing white turbans. Ayman al-Zawahiri, 71, who took over al-Qaeda after Osama bin Laden's death in 2011, was killed by a U.S. drone strike in Kabul, July 31. An Egyptian physician who joined his first jihadist cell in his teens, Zawahiri helped plan the September 11, 2001 attacks, as well as the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Biden administration officials have said Zawahiri remained in charge of the terrorist group up until his death. The killing of Zawahiri with two bladed missiles in Afghanistan's capital demonstrated the deadly power and reach of U.S. intelligence services, even a full year after President Biden withdrew all U.S. forces from the country. But one aspect of the assassination is alarming. Counterterrorism experts, its precise location. The fact that al-Qaeda's top leader was living with his family in an expensive neighborhood in downtown Kabul broke into public view the degree to which the Taliban has given al-Qaeda's leadership license to operate inside the country. Zawahiri was described as a guest of a leader of the Haqqani Network, a terrorist militia that holds ministerial positions in the government. We believe there were senior members of the Haqqani Network who are affiliated with the Taliban who did know that al-Zawahiri was in Kabul, Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, said on NBC News. Security experts also warn the Taliban could once again allow al-Qaeda to use the country as a safe haven to plot attacks. Zawahiri was being given VIP treatment in Kabul, says Bruce Hoffman, an expert on counterterrorism and homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations. One can only imagine the kind of treatment that other al-Qaeda officials and fighters are getting, Hoffman says. Died. We're still in milestones. Issey Miyake. Known for his signature pleats and avant-garde cuts and for designing Steve Jobs' iconic turtleneck, Issey Miyake, who died of liver cancer at 84, August 5, viewed fashion as a medium for innovation. He opened his studio in 1970 and put Japan at the forefront of the global fashion scene with his technical precision and creative vision, turning out wondrous garments that transcended gender, size, race, and age. As a child growing up in Hiroshima, he survived the 1945 U.S. atomic bomb blast, and his approach to design had an innately humane quality. Miyake was also refreshingly pragmatic, dedicated to creating items that were comfortable, affordable, and practical enough for everyday use. Design is not for philosophy, he once famously quipped. It is for life. Katie Lang wrote that column, and there's a small almost thumbnail photo of Issey Miyake, wearing what appears to be a blue turtleneck shirt. He has dark hair in this photo, looking solemnly at the camera, I would say. He has a bit of a mustache, and he appears to be posing behind fabric, orange, blue, yellow, purple, brown. Still in milestones, four very brief items died. NBA icon and civil rights activist Bill Russell at 88, July 31. Barrier-breaking Star Trek actor Nichelle Nichols at 89, July 30. Released Uvalde school shooting victim Maya Zamora, 10, from a hospital after more than 60 days, July 29. Suspended Uganda's leading LGBTQ rights charity, August 5, by the country's government, which also enforces some of the world's toughest anti-LGBTQ laws. Arrested a suspect in the killing of four Muslim men in Albuquerque, New Mexico, August 9. The shootings had led several Muslim residents to isolate at home or leave town. The brief world. Architecture. Building the Designs of the Future by Nicola Chilton. The shimmering torus-shaped Museum of the Future in Dubai is covered in Arabic calligraphy and is supported not by traditional columns but by a steel diagrid with a facade of 1,024 steel panels. The aviation industry provided inspiration for the technology needed to create the exterior that was developed using learning algorithms. All the parameters structurally were put into a program, and eventually it learned to create this shape, says architect Sean Killa. Opened in February 2022, the building is an iconic addition to Dubai's already dramatic skyline, which includes the sail-shaped Burj Al Arab and the Burj Khalifa, the tallest building in the world. These modern, globally recognizable structures have made a name for Dubai's architecture. But the story of Dubai's urban landscape goes back much further. Often, the story is that since the 2000s, it's been a place of gleaming skyscrapers, says architect and writer Todd Rice, author of Showpiece City, How Architecture Made Dubai. But the creative fusion seen in the architecture of structures like Killa's Museum of the Future goes deeper. I think what has had the most influence on the city is the fact that it's an entrepot, a port city, says Rice. It's a place of exchange and in-betweenness, where not only things and people come in and out, but so do ideas. That exchange of ideas has led to some of the world's most ambitious architectural projects, in which Killa has played an outsized role. And that last name is spelled K-I-L-L-A. Killa first arrived in Dubai from South Africa in 1998, joining architecture firm Atkins, where he worked on the Burj Al Arab, one of Dubai's most famous buildings, which sits on an artificial island and is shaped like the sail of a yacht. For an architect coming from Cape Town, the scale of the building was so much bigger, Killa says of Dubai. If you are used to smaller projects, it is quite a challenge to overcome that scale. Killa went on to work on other major projects in Dubai, such as the Dubai Opera, the Address Boulevard, and the Almas Tower, the tallest building in Dubai at the time. Killa launched his own architecture studio, Killa Design, in 2015, with a desire to make futuristic buildings that combine engineering innovation and technology. Sustainability is also a driving force. For the Bahrain World Trade Center, BWTC, completed in 2008, Keela worked with wind tunnel and bridge specialists to create a building that's made up of two wing-shaped structures with three 30-meter wind turbines suspended between them. The structures funnel wind onto the turbines, which generate up to 15% of the building's power. Keela has helped advance architectural innovation in Dubai through his challenging designs and to demonstrate the capacity to construct them using the latest technologies in the market, says George Khashami, director of the Center for Research, Innovation, and Design at the American University in Dubai. Keela also sees the importance of focusing on the livability of buildings and cities and creating more cyclable and walkable areas. There's a strong emphasis on creating a better place to live with greater diversity, he says. With its unusual facade, the Museum of the Future, located in Dubai's financial district, features frequently on Instagram posts. And like the city itself, it has become a place of exchange, an outsized space where people gather, marvel, and commune. That enjoyment that I saw people having really filled me with something that was very special, Keela says, of the public reception to the museum. The building has now been passed to them. Space Time by Jeffrey Kluger, editor at large. That's K-L-U-G-E-R. History remembers October 4, 1957. A lot better than it remembers January 4, 1958. Although in recent weeks, the second date is coming to loom larger than the first. October 4, 1957 was the day the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the world's first satellite. An achievement that heralded the start of the space age. Russ satellite circling Earth, shouted the Los Angeles Times in a banner headline. Reds fire moon into sky, yelped the Chicago Daily Tribune. There was no such hyperventilating, however, 3 months later, to the day, when the little 184-pound beach ball-sized satellite, having slowly lost altitude over the months because of atmospheric drag, fell from the sky, burning up like a small meteor in the fiery heat of reentry. With that, the world's first satellite became the world's first piece of plummeting space debris. It would by no means be the last. Ever since then, a massive belt of cosmic junk has been accumulating around Earth, posing a collision risk to spacecraft and menacing the 7.7 billion of us on the planet below. July 30, the 25-ton core stage of a Chinese Long March 5B rocket fell uncontrollably from the sky. Up to 40% of the booster survived re-entry. Debris rained down on Borneo. No casualties or property damage reported, but debris is near villages and a few hundred meters either way could have been a different story, tweeted astrophysicist Jonathan McDowell of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. The incident was especially troubling because most national space programs and private sector aerospace companies design their rockets to have enough maneuvering fuel left aboard to land at planned spots in the ocean or on vast stretches of unpopulated steppe or desert. The Long March 5B has no such guidance system. But it is not only China that's been a menace recently. Last month, a 10-foot-tall, monolith-like piece of debris landed on an Australian farm. Thanks to a serial number on one of the panels, it has been identified as belonging to SpaceX. NASA said SpaceX confirmed the object was likely part of a Dragon spacecraft, a segment of the vehicle known as the trunk that was jettisoned when the Dragon returned to Earth last May, carrying a crew from the International Space Station. Typically, the trunk burns up entirely in the atmosphere, reported the Federal Aviation Administration in a statement, but in this case, a dangerously large piece of it survived. NASA had little to say about the SpaceX incident, with Administrator Bill Nelson reserving his fire for China instead. All spacefaring nations should follow established best practices and do their part to share this type of information in advance. In the genteel parlance of diplomat speak, that counts as a dressing down. But finger wagging will not solve anything. With private and public launches increasing, space debris will only get worse. The Atlantic Council think tank has called for an international framework for orbital traffic management, reporting and sharing information on launches and reentries, and developing ways to collect and clear some of the junk from orbit. Achieving security, economic, and societal objectives in the 21st century hinges on free and open access to outer space, the authors of the Council's report wrote. Now is the time to act and protect a future of security and prosperity in space. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent, Dateline Las Vegas. Senator Catherine Cortez Masto stood by the kitchen doors of a Latino-owned restaurant about 5 miles east of the neon-soaked Las Vegas Strip. The senator strode in, seemingly knowing most of the crowd, who called her Catherine to her face and La Senadora to everyone else. Latinos, it's what we do. We open businesses, said Nevada's first female senator, the only Latina ever elected to the Senate. We are part of the community. We are entrepreneurs. The whole pitch on Latino solidarity took less than 2 minutes, but it was better than anything she could have scripted in an ad. After all, as the signs taped to the support columns pointed out, the woman who took the time to visit with them that day was Una de las Nuestras, one of ours. The matchup against Republican Adam Laxalt is seen as a two-point race, or maybe even closer than that, and one that could decide if the Democrats hold their narrow majority in the Senate. If Democrats end up on the receiving end of a national drubbing this fall, but Cortez Masto somehow survives, the Hispanic vote will have played a pivotal role. Strategists anticipate 15% to 20% of the Nevada electorate identify as Hispanic or Latino. Yet according to polling conducted in July by Emerson College, a solid one-third of them are backing Laxalt, a former state attorney general. For context, that is about the same support Donald Trump enjoyed in 2020, when he came within 2 points of winning Nevada, battling headwinds now blasting in Democrats' faces. In just a couple of minutes of this article, the risk report by Ian Bremmer, a fragile Israel-Gaza truce holds for now. An August 7 Egyptian brokered truce in Gaza between Israel and the militant group Palestinian Islamic Jihad, PIJ, appears to be largely holding, pausing another round of violence that began days earlier and has killed dozens of Palestinians and sent rockets flying from Gaza to within 3 miles of Jerusalem. However, Israeli forces killed at least 3 Palestinians in a shootout August 9 during a raid against militants in the occupied West Bank. Unfortunately, this latest deadly showdown between Israel and PIJ is likely a precursor of more conflict to come. It is never easy to pinpoint exactly when and why a flare-up in fighting between Israel and Palestinians begins. Before this month's violence, at least 53 Palestinians were killed from March to July including Palestinian-American Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. During the same period, a spate of attacks by Palestinians killed at least 19 people in Israel. In recent weeks, Israeli officials had begun to fear that PIJ was preparing for more violence in the West Bank. August 1, Israeli police arrested Bassam al-Saadi, PIJ's leader in the West Bank, in the city of Jenin, home to two of the attackers who had killed Israelis. The militant group immediately began issuing threats. This was not al-Saadi's first arrest, but tensions spiked further when a video was released showing the force used to subdue him and an Israeli police dog biting him. Then, August 5, Israel launched strikes into Gaza that killed a senior PIJ commander. The militant group responded by firing dozens of rockets into Israeli territory. August 6, Israel launched more airstrikes into Gaza, and PIJ sharply increased the number of rockets it fired, though there have been no Israeli deaths or injuries reported so far. The violence continued into August 7, with the Palestinian death toll reaching at least 46, including 16 children and 4 women. Gaza's health ministry says more than 360 Palestinians were also wounded. Even if the current ceasefire remains in force, the risk remains that the next war will be even more destructive. And that article was abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.